One of them was powerful rockets, the German V-2, which was being tested in White Sands. That's where we tested our first nuclear weapon. And radar, which is the beginning of the electronics revolution. We had our best radar there because sometimes the rockets went south instead of north. The Mexican government wasn't very happy about that. There weren't bombs on board these rockets, but you still don't want somebody splattering, you know, your local countryside with rockets. And I tell people, there's only one place in the world where you could study all three of those areas of technology in 1947, southeastern New Mexico, Roswell plus White Sands. And incidentally, in April, I will be part of a tour of New Mexico. The nuclear weapons test place is open 2 days a year. The first Saturday in April and the first Saturday in October. So if you want to see that nuclear weapon test site, no, it's not dangerously radioactive or anything. But it's kind of neat to be able to see where this took place. There's still a chance to do it. Sign up now. There's my book about Roswell. And, you know, one of the crazy criticisms I get, ah, come on, Stan, why would all those Roswell witnesses go running to you with their story? The simple answer is they didn't. Well, how'd you find out about it? Didn't they come to you? No. I was at a television station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Supposed to do three interviews promoting my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. And I'd done the first two. This is in 1978. And the third reporter was nowhere to be found. This is before cell phones and stuff. So the station manager is giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He knew I had other things to do. Out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. For an investigator that I am, I said, who's he? His next sentence changed my life. He handled wreckage of one of those saucers you were interested in when he was in the military. What? And he wasn't joking. I mean, we were just the two of us. He was very serious. Well, what do you know about him? Well, he lives in Houma. I didn't know where Houma was. That didn't help me much. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. The reporter showed up. I did my thing. I was busy the rest of the day. The next day from the airport, I figured things went so well. I called information, got a number for Jesse Marcel. It's before the internet. And he told me a story, because I mentioned Bill Allen, the guy who was the station manager. And that got me started. And I shared this with a colleague. And I heard another story after another lecture in Bemidji, Minnesota. And my colleague Bill Moore had a third story out of an English publication where somebody was driving across the United States and heard about a crash saucer in New Mexico in 1947. Jesse didn't have the exact date. And I knew 1947 was a big year for UFO sightings. So, that third story, English actor, hears on the radio about saucer crash in New Mexico. He had a date. How often would you take a trip from Los Angeles to Philadelphia back then? You can imagine what the roads were like. I'm sure you can imagine, as a matter of fact. Because he would have gone through Texas in 1947. Anyway, early July 1947, Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, Periodicals Department. There was a story. Verified what Jesse had told us, told me. Gave us a bunch more names, and in the next year and a half, we found 62 people in connection with that event. Kept us busy. The first book came out in 1980. We kept at it by 1986. It was 92 people. And so if one of the lucky, and sure, you get lucky. I'm not saying this is all sheer talent. I called the Roswell, I looked it up, and there's a newspaper in Roswell. What do I know from Roswell? The Roswell Daily Record. So I called, asked for the editor from 1947. This was in 1978. Oh, long gone. What do you need? Well, I've got articles here that say the base public information officer, Walter Haut, his name is spelled four different ways in the press coverage, talked about a crash sausage. Before I could finish the sentence, oh, his wife works here. What? You don't expect the GI from Chicago, mind you, as I found out later, to still be in Roswell, where he was based in 1947. His daughter's been running the museum, the UFO museum in Roswell, incidentally. Anyway, talk to the wife, talk to Walter. He was a great help. He had a copy of the base yearbook, like a high school yearbook, and list, had pictures and names, and he remembered a lot of the people. So we worked hard to find a lot of those people. They didn't come running to me. It's sweat is the big effort it takes to do this sort of stuff. Anyway, and yeah, since then I've had a few people contact me. They knew I was involved with the Roswell investigation. But they weren't looking for anything. Jesse wasn't. See, Jesse Marcel could not deny, as I found out later, his involvement because his name and picture were in a lot of newspapers. I didn't know that when I talked to him. But it's true. Even a Chinese newspaper had Jesse's picture. It was a very big story for 2 days. But it's still a story now, after a little delay in there. So, if you know somebody who knows something about Roswell, and is still alive, I have trouble with the dead ones, but I don't know how to reach them, but that's a different area of the paranormal from mine. People are reluctant to speak, and I understand that. I had a clearance for 14 years, and people say, well, surely these guys all told their wives. No. The MJ-12 guys, of course they didn't tell their wife. I've never told my wife anything classified. It'd be crazy to do that. I can't control what she's going to say to somebody else. You take an oath, you protect your oath. Anybody here have a clearance ever in the military? Raise a hand if anybody has. Just real quick. Okay, I won't tell anybody. I think you know what I mean when I say you don't open your mouth when you shouldn't. Not even to your wife. Any wives out there, sorry about that, but you're not letting on everything going on. Okay. Now, this story's been around, the Aztec story, since, the 50s. And it was disgraced and discarded and so forth. But then the two authors of this new book just came out a few months ago. I wrote the foreword. I had a few copies over here. Suzanne and Scott Ramsey really dug into this, spent a ton of money finding documents, finding people. And look, you people here in the radio know that you don't talk to outsiders very casually coming to, say, a small town away from the big cities. In other words, if you fly into someplace near Aztec and you start opening your mouth, there aren't many people who are going to talk to you. They don't want to. Why should they? They haven't had good experience with people making big noises. So Suzanne, her family lives up that area. They got to know a lot of people and eventually got to a lot of prime witnesses. This happened in March of 1948. And this was a big one, about 90-some feet in diameter. One of the key questions, supposedly it was carried from there to Los Alamos. And people said, oh, there's no way you could get it there. It's a big old thing. Well, suppose it was cut into three pieces. Well, come on, look at the roads. So Scott hired somebody whose job it was to plan travel for large mechanical components, generators and stuff like that. You know, power plants, they've got big stuff. And you got to worry about, you know, where there's a bridge, a tunnel, tight roads, et cetera, et cetera. They went over the route, looked at the old maps. This guy didn't believe in flying saucers, but he had to concede when they finally got finished. Yes, with the technology then available, they could have moved this from Aztec to Los Alamos. Why Los Alamos? Because it's a major laboratory with all kinds of capability, usually 7,000-8,000 people work there. I recommend the book because it's going to shock a few people. They've been flying, dropping out of the sky all along the way here, it looks like. Now, there's another case in Brazil, incidentally, Varginha. which I heard about when I was down there. And a lot of good work been done on that one. So, Alien Zero Defects program doesn't work. Sometimes they make mistakes, just like the rest of us. Aztec is in the northwest corner, the Four Corners area, where New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada come together there. It's out in the middle of nowhere, frankly. A story broke this year. Strange story. A guy named Chase Brandon, the guy on the left, came forward to say that he worked for the CIA, and when he was in a closed facility, he saw a box marked Roswell, so he opened it up. He had the clearance, and inside found convincing evidence that Roswell really happened. He's not going to tell you the details of what he found. The other guy in the picture on the right is Lee Spiegel, works for Huffington Post, and posts a lot of material. He's been around a long time. He arranged the United Nations hearings on UFOs in 1978. I was part of that. Anyway, he met with Chase Brandon, and we have since found out that, indeed, Chase did work for the CIA and was close to the movie industry, which needs advice from government people on how to portray things and so forth. And that story got a lot of attention. Some people say, well, obvious nonsense. My first reaction was, Chase Brandon? The producer of my movie, UFOs Are Real, was Brandon Chase, which seemed real coincidence. But I just 4 days ago was looking at a book, a novel, in which the acknowledgments were given to various government people who had helped out. It was a spy kind of novel. And one of the people listed was Chase Brandon of the CIA. He definitely worked for the CIA, no question about it. And he still isn't telling anybody what the actual details of what he saw were. You know anybody else like that? Tell them to call me. This is that science was wrong, all those false claims by smart people of what was impossible. And I can't sell you one because they didn't arrive. This one came out last year, and it's got 13 chapters. I wrote two of them. The other 11 were by 11 different people. Our publisher put together this compilation. Leslie Kane, oh no, this is John Alexander. He says there is no cover-up. He knows everybody in Washington, and he asked a lot of people where the secret work is going on. And he said that he couldn't find any evidence that there was any secret outfit, no MJ-12 or anybody like that. And I asked him, still haven't gotten an answer, I said, John, you had a high-level clearance. How many times did you tell people who didn't have a need to know and an appropriate clearance what you knew that was classified? And I think the answer is zero. But he wrote a book in which he says myths, he says flying saucers are real, but there's no MJ-12, there's no group collecting this information. It's just, they don't care. I strongly disagree. Here's a good book. Leslie she's a top-notch reporter, and she's got in this book testimony from generals and pilots from all over the world in their own words, and it's powerful stuff. When you read a top-notch general in Iran, whose pilots chased the UFO, and then something came out of the UFO, went back and chased the pilots, powerful stuff. It's always nice to be recognized by your peers. This, what I'm holding there is I was inducted into the Roswell UFO Hall of Fame. And the local paper carried an article about it, and the cartoonist went to town with that. I thought that's kind of nice, frankly. I mean, if you're going to have a cartoon, at least it should be friendly. And kind of the bottom line here, where do we fit in the universe? We will spend $1 trillion this year, we Earthlings. We have a lousy track record. We would be a menace to all those in our neighborhood. Thanks for listening. I'll try to answer your questions. Thank you very much. where would be a good place for the motherships to be hidden? Under the water. Well, it's a guy, anyway, he's got a book out about USOs, underwater, or unidentified submerged objects. He's got over 1,000 accounts from all over the world of objects going into the water or coming out of it. And if these things work by magneto-aerodynamics, it could work in water, too, because seawater is an electrically conducting fluid. That would be one place. There are plenty unexplored places on the planet if you're able to fly wherever you darn please. You know, jungles and so forth, rivers, wherever. We think we know a lot about the planet, but we only know about the places that are sort of occupied by people in general. They also might be on the backside of the moon. That's a good point. Convenient place because it's hard for us to see there. Unless you believe that we have a base on the moon, on the backside of the moon. Front side wouldn't be any good. You know. Other questions? Yes. Tonight, I will show some pictures of an electromagnetic submarine invented by Dr. Stuart Way of Westinghouse Research Labs. No moving parts. And his students at University of California, Santa Barbara, actually built an electromagnetic submarine. There was an article in Time magazine about it. Technical papers presented at professional society meetings. And the Japanese built one using superconducting magnets from Kawasaki, who's the big Japanese firm. I think it's Kawasaki. And these things work. But there's an old law of physics. If you have electric and magnetic fields at right angles to each other, you have a force at right angles to both. And you push against it, and by Newton's law, it pushes back, and you go slipping silently through the seawater. And you say, what's that got to do with in the air? Well, if you ionize the air to produce the glow, you can interact with electric and magnetic fields and control lift, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, those are kind of nifty things. Well, back in 1970, when I was starting on what sounded like it would be the best job of my life, I was offered a job at McDonnell Douglas Astronautics. You want me to look away? Okay. My job was going to be to figure out how flying saucers work. And I was driving across the country when I found out that the program was canceled. It was part of the MOLE program, Manned Orbiting Laboratory. But one of the things I did get done in the 3 months they were nice enough to keep me on, having driven across the country to join them, what a greeting when you go to the business office, hear my offer letter, you realize we just laid off 5,000 people. Yes, I do realize that. Anyway, one of the things I had done was a literature search of the government report literature using one keyword, magneto-aerodynamics. Got 900 references. 90% were classified. Somebody was paying a lot of attention. That wasn't the general open scientific literature. That was just government literature. You got a contract, you got to write a report. You know, quarterly report, semi-annual report, annual report. So, yeah, I think you can get around all the problems of high-speed flight. It wouldn't be cheap. These things never are. So I think magneto-aerodynamics, and I talked about it in my congressional testimony, as a matter of fact, gave references. This isn't blue sky. I mean, somebody thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if blah, blah, blah. Experimental results. So if there's anybody here who worked on one of those programs, I'd like to hear about it. Was classified back then, I guess. Other question. Yes, way in the back. Why would the government deny this? Flying saucers? I mean, why don't they tell us what they know, those blankety-blank guys? Let me give you six reasons. And fear of panic is not one of them. People always bring up Orson Welles, you know, War of the Worlds, all that kind of stuff. First reason is you want to figure out how the darn things work. They make wonderful weapons delivery and defense systems. Can fly circles around anything we got flying. You see your secret project. You've got wreckage. You send out parts to some of the best labs, classified labs in the country. rule number one for security. You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. They read the newspapers, listen to the radio, etc. Second problem, the other side of the same coin. What if somebody else figured out how they worked before we did? They're seen all over the world. How do we defend against them? We don't want them to know. We know they know. Weapon, counter-weapon, counter-counter-weapon. We've been playing this game a long time. Bigger spears, stronger shields, you know, same difference. Third problem is different. What if there were an announcement tomorrow by two highly trusted individuals around the world, a little hard to find, but my favorite couple would be the Pope and the Queen. They're about the same age. What if they were to go public saying we have it on reliable authority that our planet is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft? What would happen? The stock market would go down. Mental hospital admissions would go up. You know, all kinds of things like that would happen. But I think one of the things that would happen is that the younger generation, who, unlike me, was never alive when there wasn't a space program, you don't realize how anti the notion of space travel was back, let's say, in the 40s. Family member, he's a smart kid, but why is he talking about space? Something a little off, was the attitude kind of thing. Anyway, for the younger generation, I think one of the first reactions, based on over 600 college talks, is that the push should be toward an earthling orientation for all of us. It's obviously from an alien viewpoint that we're, you know, we're all Americans, Peruvians, Greeks, Chinese, whatever you want. But from a sensible viewpoint, you'd say, from an alien viewpoint, we're all earthlings. Like it or not, we don't seem to like it very much. I know of no government on this planet that wants its people to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. Nationalism is the only game in town. When I live in Canada, we got Quebec wanting to be its own country, too. The next problem is a little different. Pat Robertson. You're all familiar with Pat, I gather. He has loudly proclaimed, the only intelligent life in the universe is here on planet Earth. I don't know how anybody could make such a stupid statement, but anyway. All this UFO stuff is the work of the devil, he said. Well, he'd be up the creek without a religious paddle if some announcement were to be made, wouldn't he? The fifth problem is people said to me, Stan, look, if they're coming here and we're not going there, that means they're more advanced technologically than we are, right? Yes. Well, it's going to be an economic disaster. I mean, pretty soon we'll replace oil with something better. There go the oil companies. Ground transport, air transport, there go those companies. Computers, communication system, economic chaos. And I say, yeah, there's some truth to that. We're not making many buggy whips anymore, but I think we can survive it. The sixth reason, on seven different occasions, I have quietly heard from people telling me that they were aware of military pilots who went up to chase UFOs who never came back. If I've heard seven such stories, there are a lot more mounted. And I get different reactions to that. People say, well, surely they would have told families. No. As a matter of fact, there's a book, By Any Means Necessary, talking about 166 American military, Air Force actually, guys, whose job it was just after the war, late 40s, early 50s mostly, to tickle the radar over Korea, China, and Russia. Dash in and see how quickly the radar came on, what frequency it was used, and so forth. And we had radio communications from these guys. A whole bunch of planes got shot down. Nothing in the press. The families were told nothing. Unfortunate accident. Plane went down at sea. Sorry. Until 2001, they called a conference in which they brought in the families, gave them the medals their sons brothers, whatever it was, had earned, and told them what happened to them. 166 military veterans. Of course, I didn't say we shot down some Russian planes, too, and didn't say anything about those either. This is what happens in Cold Wars. They get hot once in a while. So, if they can keep that secret, and I should add, of course, that orders were issued. This is documented in the newspapers. 1952, when that big wave of sightings went on, pilots were ordered, shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, you can think of all the cartoons, you know, down and, you know, what the other symbol would be. But if we knew what was going on, we'd think a lot differently about this whole thing. One case was very interesting. A guy he's as old as I am, I guess. He was a Navy pilot on duty in South Carolina, sitting around doing nothing, really, but they got a contact from the air control outfit, bogey in sight, you know, so he was scrambled. Dashes out at 10 o'clock at night, dashes into the airplane that's always kept waiting for him, talks to the guys on the radio, and is scrambled. Up he goes, gets up 20,000 feet. Where is he? They tell him he's down below, and suddenly the craft comes up straight and then toward him. And a beam of light comes at him. He put up his hand. You can see the bones in his hand, which must be a pretty crazy sensation. And what's he going to do? Well, he's going to shoot at the darn thing because it's attacking him. Pulls the trigger and nothing happened because the guns hadn't been loaded. Now, the guy on the ground is listening to all this discussion, standard practice. And the UFO goes its way. He lands. He gets interrogated for hours by guys in suits and guys in uniforms, finding out exactly what happened and so forth. And I've talked to this guy, very sharp guy. Like I say, he went on to be a lawyer. I'm not going to hold that against him. And it was fascinating to talk to him because we agreed. The only reason he was alive is because his guns hadn't been loaded. And as I said, if I've heard of seven such stories, there's got to be a lot more out there. People had to tell somebody, and I seem trustworthy because I'm willing to stick my neck out, you know. So, there's a whole bunch of stories out there that haven't been told. Any other questions? We're just about out of time. Yes. Yes, I'm familiar with Dr. Stephen Greer and the Disclosure Project. Well, I've known Steve for a long time. I've heard him speak. I've read his stuff. And I don't trust him. He's made a lot of claims that haven't been substantiated. And, he talked about free energy having been developed and told you to invest in a certain company because they'd be building these devices. It's never happened. That was years ago. There are other claims like that, when he brings out flash searchlights and tries to bring in the UFOs, and when people who were there at the same occasion say they didn't see what he claims that was seen. It's a long story. And I'm not trying to make a point of attacking him. That's why I didn't bring him up. But if you're going to ask me, I'm going to tell you. Three comments, one question. Okay. About Steve Greer. Oh, there's a big mountain in California called Shasta. Yes, very big mountain. It's supposedly the home of all kinds of crazy things going on, to tell you the truth. It's a big mountain. I mean, it's 14,000 or so feet. And I've heard those stories. And I know that people have seen strange things up there, but I can't verify that there's a base or other things going on there. It's in my gray basket. Not enough data. Number two. Did you report this to anybody? We're getting a lot of reports of small things inside the house. Bright lights, scare the hell out of people sometimes. Because what is it? You're not accustomed to having things like that going around your room. Okay, you had a third. There are a lot of reports of strange phenomena in people's homes, for want of a better word. And we don't know what's going on. The aliens have some strange capabilities. One of them, and this really sounds weird, is to take people through solid walls. I've listened to a tape of a hypnosis session, and you can tell the woman is totally mystified. It went right through the wall. How could that be? You know, trying to make sense out of that. And sure, most of us is nothing. If you look at an atom and stuff, it's mostly nothing with a little something sprinkled around. But we don't know how they do that. They've got capabilities we don't seem to have yet. Yet. So I think it may be a manifestation of them. I mean, they're doing a thesis for their class. You know, alien technology, alien meaning us. Well, how are you going to find out more? Well, you put up your device inside their house, and you have sensors that send out signals. And I realize that sounds weird. But much of what we do today, look at this thing up here. If I had described the Internet to you 60 years ago, what would you have said? Lock them up. You know, and Moore's Law, famous man, head of a big company, found out that the number of transistors you could put on a chip was doubling about every year or two, which doesn't sound like much until you multiply and multiply and multiply. And, you know, my wife went in to buy something for her computer. They were selling terabyte devices. You got kilobyte, megabyte, gigabyte, terabyte. Tremendous amount of information. You can store it in something this big. Incredible. Impossible. But we're moving in that direction. So there's a lot going on that indicates that our technology 20 years from now, I won't be around to see it, but it's going to be a hell of a lot different than it is now. And I don't know how to explain it. These guys are more advanced than we are. They know things we don't know. Sorry about that. Anyway, thank you very much.